Welcome to The Man from 2063, where the past meets the future with Jack Duffy, here on Blog Talk Radio. Whether it's conspiracy theories, politics, current events, sports, entertainment, or historical events, Jack will keep you fascinated with entertaining guests on every show. This show is no hold bars. Now your host, Jack Duffy.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks again for tuning into my show. We've got another fantastic guest. As always, I've been very lucky to have such really outstanding people on my show, and tonight's no exception. I'm honored to have Liz Peek as my guest tonight. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her background. Liz was one of the first women on Wall Street to become a partner. After graduating with an honors degree in economics from Wesley College, she joined a research boutique on Wall Street where she developed an improbable expertise in backhoes, mining equipment, oil field wireline services, and drilling fluids. She moved to Western, another company, a leading equities house, which subsequently was bought by Schroeder Incorporated. And then she's done a lot more than that. She's the first woman to head the National Association of Petroleum Investment Analysts, a national organization for several hundred energy investors. She's a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal, the Oil and Gas Journal, the Wall Street Transcript, and other industry periodicals. She's been a guest on Wall Street Week. In recent years, she's been a columnist with the Fiscal Times and FoxNews.com. For several years, she was the business columnist for the New York Sun. She's also written for the Huffington Post, the Motley Fool, and published a weekly column on women on the web. She's also contributed articles to Trends, a business periodical in the Middle East, Avenue, and the New York Observer. She's a regular guest on FoxNews.com Live and has appeared on other TV programs, including Larry Kudlow and Fox and Friends. Wow, that's a pretty impressive resume, Liz. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine. It's like drowning. I just saw my whole life go by me. Yeah, I think what's pertinent is that I'm a columnist these days and writing for Fox News on their website and also for a group called the Fiscal Times, and I'm delighted to be joining you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I understand you've been writing quite a lot lately about the ISIS situation and terrorism in general. Tell us a little bit what you've been doing and what kind of research you've been doing on that, what you think about what's going on over there in Iraq and Syria right now.
Well, like everybody else, I'm pretty frustrated by President Obama's seeming inability to call out these savage butchers for what they are, which is Islamic terrorists. Obviously, he's doing athletic maneuvers, contortions, to avoid using that kind of language. And look, I understand why. I understand that he doesn't want to feed the narrative that we're at war with Islam, but the truth of the matter is the people who are attacking us, who are killing our American hostages and hostages of other countries and committing all these barbarous acts are Islamic radicals. And I think, unfortunately, to minimize who they are and what they want, which is really to conquer every other faith and to conquer most of the Middle East, is basically just playing into their hands. Anyway, the president disagrees with that. He thinks that he has to be overtly, cautious about his relationship with the Muslim world. But the problem is our relationship with the Muslim world has only gotten worse under his leadership. And now, our polls, I was looking at our international polling this morning, and approval of the United States in most of the Arab world has dropped precipitously since Obama took office. So this is not how he expected this situation to go, and I think part of his temerity in kind of calling a spade is because he had come into office with great high hopes about he was going to be the person to heal the rift between the Muslim world and the West because of his childhood, because of his familiarity with Muslims, that he really could sort of bridge this divide. And it just hasn't turned out that way. So he's living in a bit of a fantasy land where this is all going to get better. I've read very carefully all that he has said on this topic. Really what he just simply does not want to do is undertake military action against ISIS. And we've seen the result of that. Unfortunately, his reluctance to arm the Kurds, really was a tremendous disadvantage for that group, which was one of our few militaristic allies in this fight. Today, astonishingly, the White House and the State Department refused to condone Egypt's raids in Libya, which were, of course, in retaliation for the beheading of all those Egyptian Christians. So, you know, President Obama is sort of at odds with America right now because Americans are horrified by what they see. I think most of us are a little alarmed that this thing is seemingly spiraling out of control. I think we're also alarmed that our president doesn't seem to have a plan. That, of course, was sort of acknowledged and had became sort of a joke. But the truth is, I don't think we have a plan as to how to confront these terrorists. So, you know, that the conclusion is, the unwanted conclusion is, that we are vulnerable. We're only going to become more vulnerable as this group continues to radicalize and convert a lot of people in Europe and in the West and in the United States. And I think we all feel very on edge about it. And again, we're not really getting much kind of confidence, or we don't have much confidence in our president keeping us safe. So none of this is good news, obviously, for the country, and it's also not good news for the president because his polling on international affairs and so forth is sinking like a stone. It also isn't terribly good news, by the way, for Hillary Clinton, because try as she might, as she undertakes her run for president in 2016, it's going to be pretty darn hard for her to claim no involvement, no responsibility for the rather lame foreign policy that we've had. So, you know, anyway, I think there's some interesting things happening. The president has made it clear in his comments to the terrorism summit that we have to do a better job of confronting ISIS propaganda, and I would agree with that 100%. He's been mocked for talking about tweeting and so forth, but apparently ISIS has been sending their message around the world with something like 95,000 social media hits every day. And I wrote a piece not long ago about what America's propaganda effort looks like, and you probably won't be surprised to know that it is extraordinarily inert. For the last several years, we've had a lot of interagency squabbling over Voice of America management and the management of the other units of that broader agency, which is supposed to be sending a pro-America message out to the world. You probably also won't be surprised to know that journalists working for that organization, which, by the way, finally has a CEO in place and hopefully will be getting its act together, but the people working there are somewhat miffed that they might actually have to have a pro-America message. So we are so far behind the eight ball on this, it is ludicrous. And I actually do believe, as the president does, that it's an incredibly important job that this government needs to undertake yesterday. I mean, they really need to get off the ground and start really confronting the propaganda, the hailstorm of propaganda coming out of ISIS with, you know, a different message, something that can confront that and possibly, subvert that, hopefully. So, you know, a lot going on.
Well, what do you think is the strategy, or should be our strategy, to fight this terrorist group? I mean, they seem to be getting stronger and stronger, and we don't seem to be doing anything to stop them except, you know, using some airstrikes. But what do you think Obama's strategy should be, or what would you suggest?
Well, I think one of the discouraging things in the last two or three weeks turns out that it turns out that while President Obama has always talked about how we will do everything possible, we're doing everything possible, turns out we're not doing everything possible. And that has led to a fraying of whatever modest coalition the president has built. For example, the UAE, United Arab Emirates, dropped out of the bombing coalition in December, we come to find out a week or so ago, because the United States was not prepared to station rescue aircraft anywhere near where the bombing sorties were taking place. The implication was that this sad Jordanian pilot who was captured and then burned alive might have been saved had we had a better rescue apparatus at hand. Now, I have no idea if that's true or not, but now I gather the UAE has resumed its activities. Whether we changed course on that, I don't know. But anyway, that's one example of where we have not come through with what has been requested. Obviously, there are many others, starting with arming the Kurds. You know, the best thing for the United States is obviously people on the ground willing to take up the fight against ISIS. And look, this is all very complicated. And so it's easy to be an armchair quarterback and say, look, I know all the answers. I don't. But I am pretty sure that I'm pretty sure that our State Department has been on the left foot constantly, you know, backing the wrong horses. You know, in retrospect, and of course, retrospect is easier, but an awful lot of people at the time thought that calling for the overthrow of Mubarak was an enormous mistake. Egypt is a longtime ally. Mubarak was a long-term ally. Yes, he was a despot, but guess what? The Muslim Brotherhood who took over were even worse. And so, of course, now they're out too. But we historically, the United States historically, has backed, in a sense, stability in the Middle East, whether it's the Saudis or Mubarak or whoever. And yes, that isn't... And by the way, worked to some degree, not perhaps very effectively, to push democratic reforms in those countries in exchange for our support. You know, when you throw over somebody like Mubarak, you're inviting chaos, and that's in fact what happened. So, could we have prevented a change of government there? I don't know, but we certainly didn't help the situation. And I must say now, because, you know, again, because Obama is so reluctant to have any sort of military engagement, now we're not even willing to partner with them or condone their activities in Libya. Libya is basically a gone state as far as I can see. I mean, the thing is totally now warring factions. There almost is no central government, just like Yemen. I cannot imagine why we would not look to the Egyptians for help there. So I guess to answer your question, and I've been sort of long-winded in answering it, but I would certainly arm and equip our allies on the ground to the extent that we can. And again, you know, we clearly have not. Jordan's another country that's been asking for arms, asking for help. There has been no country more supportive of the United States and more helpful to the Middle East generally than Jordan, which continues to take in refugees from Palestine, refugees from Iraq, from Syria. This is a small country that's led by King Abdullah, who, of course, went to school in the United States, is a very good friend of a lot of Americans, who understands the need for democracy. But he's been holding this little country together with scotch tape, basically, with very little help from the United States. And my gosh, if they ask for help, I cannot understand why we're not giving them everything we can. So right. That would be the first thing I would do.
Well, that's... It's an interesting situation. Of course, when they killed that pilot, that really made the king mad, obviously, and he went after him pretty hard, and which I was glad to see. And then Egypt started to come after him here just the other day because they killed all those Christians, killed them on the beach. And what do you think the answer is going to be in terms of, I mean, do you think we can ever defeat this group completely? Or, I mean, is this war winnable, in your opinion, or is it just going to be going on for decades and decades? Or what do you think? I mean,
well, you know, look, we definitely did reduce the impact of al-Qaeda. Unfortunately, al-Qaeda now has metastasized into this group, and there's Boko Haram and there's other groups. But I think that, yes, part of it is military, and I think there's enough. Look, all these Muslim nations are horrified by what's going on in the Middle East. I think they're all willing to work with us to attack them militarily. I think a complicating factor here is Obama's ambitions to sign a deal with Iran, a nuclear deal with Iran. you know, one of the things that I think is alarming about President Obama is that he has certain legacy, so to speak, issues that he wants to accomplish while in office. And it appears as though those ambitions take precedence over almost anything else. And he, unfortunately, his eagerness to please Iran, I have heard, is one of the reasons, for example, that we were not willing to arm the Kurds, because the Iranians are worried about what that might mean for them. You know, I think that Obama has to kind of put aside his eagerness to do a deal with Iran and really kind of just pay attention to this terrorist threat. That is the number one thing right now that is worrying the United States, worrying our allies in the Middle East. It is also the case that his pressure, the pressure he has put on our negotiators to conclude a deal with Iran, has really alarmed, obviously, Israel, made an antagonist out of Netanyahu, and also the Saudis, who are, of course, bitter enemies of Iran. So I think he has to kind of put that on the back burner in order to free up, our energies and our political efforts, if you will, towards fighting ISIS. That right now is what we need to do. And I do think, yes, it can be defeated. Will there always be terrorist outbursts in the Middle East? So it seems. But I think we have to be very cold-eyed about what is required here in the United States. In New York, and one of the things Obama talked about at the summit was we can't allow surveillance of Muslim communities to give rise to the feeling that they're sort of under attack here. Well, I disagree with that 100%. I live in New York City, and there are Muslim cells, radical cells. We have a pretty large Muslim community here in the greater New York City area, and we have had undercover police work going on for a number of years, ever since 9/11. And it's been very effective. They've uncovered numerous incipient plots. They have a pretty good idea of who's stirring things up, which mosques are problematic, et cetera. Unfortunately, we have a very liberal mayor now who is wanting to reverse all of that in keeping with the feelings that Obama has, that it's, an abridgment of civil rights or whatever. The truth is, the reason New York City has been safe these many years, I believe, is because we have extremely good intelligence. And I think we need to pursue that across the country, as we have been doing, and allow political correctness a time out.
Right before the Democratic Congress left power in December, there was a big deal about them criticizing Bush and Cheney for waterboarding terrorists, saying that was torture and that it was illegal and all that. What do you think about all that? Do you approve of the waterboarding techniques that were used by Bush and his administration, or what do you think about that?
Well, I don't approve of it, I guess, although I certainly understand why it was done, and I don't approve of having released this report, which, of course, just fed whatever narrative, anti-American narrative, ISIS and related groups are spinning. Nothing could have been more damaging. And honestly, I wrote about it at the time. There was completely nothing to be gained from the release of that report. What happened, I think, is that Dianne Feinstein got completely furious that the CIA had apparently tapped some phones amongst the Senate committee. And by the way, they should not have done that. And it's sort of a typical spy agency versus Congress tiff, But the truth is, to have released that thing when we're already under attack by people on ideological grounds was, I thought, unforgivable. I do tend to agree with others who have sort of said the same thing. I think Peggy Noonan, John McCain, and others, that we should hold ourselves to a higher standard. I don't think any of us saw those videos from Abu Ghraib and felt good about it. Americans are supposed to take the high road, and I think generally we do. You know, if that said, and I'll waffle here, if there was, you know, reported nuclear bomb had entered the United States in some terrorist possession, and there was a way to find it via those kinds of measures, I would not hesitate.
Right. Well, I agree with you. Cheney, of course, was on Meet the Press. I watched him, and I'm not saying he's a great guy by any means, but I know he's very intelligent, but he certainly seemed to be able to back up the reason why they used waterboarding and defended it pretty strongly, saying that it saved a lot of lives and disrupted a lot of plots, which I don't know if that's true or not. If it is true, I guess it was worth doing it to a point, but I thought it was interesting what he had to say about it.
Sure. Yeah, I agree.
Getting back to ISIS, do you write columns every week, or are you a writer as a kind of a career now, or what do you do with writing?
Yeah, I write every week for a group called the Fiscal Times, which is a bipartisan site. I'm on the right, of course, but there are some people on the left. It's a policy site aimed mainly at policymakers in the country, funded by Pete Peterson, who has long had concerns about our fiscal situation. And it's a good site because, you know, we have fact checkers. We actually do our work pretty responsibly, I think. So I recommend it to your listeners. And I also write for Fox News probably every other week or so, and occasionally for other organizations these days. But yeah, I enjoy what I do. I write about economics, politics, finance, pretty much whatever I want, which of course is what everyone dreams of doing. But I'm too cranky to take direction, so my editors just let me alone, which is good.
Have you ever had a chance to visit any of the Middle Eastern countries?
Yeah, long time ago, I was involved in the energy industries, and I visited Abu Dhabi and Dubai. I was in Egypt actually for the Cairo speech in 2009 at the invitation of a pretty senior Egyptian business leader, which was fascinating because I had an opportunity to have dinner with the so-called oligarchs of Egypt the night before the speech and then again the night after and got their reaction, which was very interesting. And I've been back to Dubai actually in the last several years. I've never been to Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. I have been to forums in the U.S. with a lot of senior Saudis and Kuwaitis, but it's very hard for women to travel in those countries.
Right. I assume you were in New York on the day 9/11 happened? Or?
I was. And like everyone else, you know, we'll never forget that day. It was pretty horrifying. My husband at the time worked downtown about a block from the World Trade Center and thankfully was on his way downtown when that happened. But his staff and, you know, everybody in the building, as I say, we'll never forget it. It was really a horror. And you know what people forget, and I don't think anyone really should forget this, is that in the aftermath, and when some of the measures were taken, which now look to have been overly zealous or whatever, nobody knew what was coming next. Now we know there was no second shoe to drop, but that was not at all clear. For weeks after 9/11, everybody in New York City was looking over their shoulder and wondering, you know, was that the first? I mean, I'll tell you, if someone had walked into Grand Central or Macy's, or any other big sort of central area and blown themselves up, this city would have been a ghost town because everyone was sort of saying, well, you know, I'll move here, I'll move there. It would have taken a decade to recover. And we were very, very lucky, and we have continued, and I'm literally knocking on wood as I say this, we've been very lucky that the Times Square bomber was apprehended and that others have been caught before they were able to enact anything really horrifying in this city. And, you know, every New Year's Eve and all these big events here, I tell you what, I'm sure a lot of people like me are just crossing their fingers that nothing terrible happens. It's scary.
Well, recently, of course, we had the North Korea thing, or allegedly where they came in and hacked Sony and, you know, used cyber warfare, and that seems to be the new another area of warfare that could hit us, you know, with terrorists. They could come in and destroy our computer systems or try to disable our computer systems. And have you read much about that or researched
that?
Sure.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting situation, because to tell you the truth, I think most people are pretty shocked that North Korea, which of course is a horrendously backward and poor country, would actually be that sophisticated. Who knows, right? I mean, it does seem as though they were the perpetrators of this thing. Obviously, as you know, there was also talk about how perhaps it was a Sony insider and that it was really cleverly disguised as a North Korean hack. I don't know, but here's much more important to me is that with all this that's going on in the Middle East, the sad thing is that we aren't even paying attention to China. China is our big geopolitical rival today. It's not Russia, it's China. And China is belligerent on a number of fronts and increasingly flexing their muscles in ways that, were the Middle East not in flames, you know, we would be paying a lot of attention to. And the sad thing is we're not. For example, there are disputed islands and disputed waters near China, areas that they dispute with Vietnam, among others. And the Chinese are going ahead and sort of colonizing some of these places and building in them and very aggressively taking property that is, you know, again, is disputed. It's not necessarily theirs. We can't really deal with that right now because we're pretty bottled up in the Middle East. You know, unfortunately, this ISIS thing kind of allows anybody else in the world who'd like to just sort of run amok. Look at Putin. You know, there's another very dangerous situation, I think. Putin is basically taunting Western Europe with all these fighter jets flying over various countries, NATO countries. Obviously being extremely provocative and aggressive in the Ukraine. And, you know, what are we doing about this? We put sanctions in place. The only thing really that's hurting Russia is the fact that oil prices have collapsed thanks to the Saudis. And what's the end game there? I have no idea. But thankfully, Western Europe is also engaged in confronting Russia. But that's a very scary thing because I think Putin is quite unreliable, and I think he has territorial ambitions beyond just the Ukraine, although when he took some portion of that country, you kind of knew, when he took the Crimea, you knew he needed a land bridge to it, so it was just a matter of time before he would try and take more land. But, I there's a lot of bad things happening in the world, and sadly, President Obama, from day one, has really simply not had interest in foreign policy. You don't have to believe me on this topic. There's a fellow named Vali Nasr, who today is the head of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins, who was in the Obama administration working under Richard Holbrooke and as a diplomat, and he was horrified by the lack of interest that this White House had in foreign affairs and the weakness that we showed and the lack of involvement. I'm afraid that all of that has sort of culminated now in a world that just seems kind of on the brink of disaster everywhere you look, and it's a very alarming picture.
Well, we have about a minute left, Liz. Is there anything you want to talk about that we haven't discussed to our listeners? It's been a great half hour with you, and I really appreciate you being on, and it's been very, very fascinating. Anything you want to wrap up with that we haven't talked about?
Well, I would love to encourage people to vote the next time round, try and elect a new, you know, try and elect a Republican president, because I really think a lot of damage has been done, and we need some very good leadership to push us back in the right direction. You know, this is a great country. We need to tell the world that we're a great country, and we need to behave like a great country. And all those things are possible, but we need leadership to do it.
Well, that's really, I agree with you completely. I couldn't agree with you more. It's been very, very fascinating talking with you tonight. I'm looking forward to reading your articles in the future. You're very, very well informed about what's going on in the world, and I know my audience has enjoyed hearing you tonight. I wish you the best in the future, and maybe we can have you on again sometime down the road and talk some more about this.
Great. That'd be my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, and good night.
All right. Good night now.
That's it for tonight for the Man from 2063 show. This is Jack Duffy. We'll be back next week with another show, another interesting guest. So in the meantime, have a great weekend. And if you're up north, don't get too cold or snowed in. I hope everything will melt sooner for you up there. The weather's been bad. But we'll be back next week with another show. Thanks. Good night.
You have been listening to The Man from 2063, where the past meets the future with Jack Duffy, every Thursday at 7 p.m. Central here on Blog Talk Radio. You can listen to this broadcast again on jackduffy.srbroadcasting.com.